The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Derek Frost from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. And we start on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal with the special report headline, New Land of Oz. Could Opportunity Zones be a boon for distressed communities, or will they just pad wealthy pockets? And inside the Triangle Business Journal, the special report begins with a second headline, Opportunities Abound in North Carolina. Investors are watching and learning about the new Opportunity Zones across North Carolina. Many of the zones include areas you might not expect. And this is written by Dane Huffman. The corner of West South and South Saunders Streets isn't much different than many in downtown Raleigh. And yet on the east side of town, the east side of Saunders Street is the start of a large new opportunity zone that stretches to the Johnston County line. The opportunity zone sprang from the 2017 Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, an effort to spur investment in distressed areas. The federal government left it to the states to establish the zones, and the North Carolina Department of Commerce, on a tight timeline, worked with local municipalities to draw them in 2018. Still, there's no yellow brick road to the Land of Oz. In October, the Treasury Department and Internal Revenue Service issued guidance on the zones, and investors, lawyers, and accountants have been scrambling to master the nuances of the rules. Now, interest is surging. Investors crowded into Raleigh's Carolina Country Club May 22 to hear from law firm Manning Fulton about the program. Manning attorney Bradley Woolridge calls interest pretty high. It's a very attractive benefit if you have the right deal and the right project, he says. Essentially, investors can take capital gains from a real estate deal, invest in an opportunity zone, and once the property is sold, get a reduction in taxes on the initial capital gains, and then pay no capital gains taxes on the opportunity zone sale. In simple terms, an investor could take $1 million profit from a real estate deal, invest in an opportunity zone, sell that investment later for a $2 million profit, and pay less tax on the original $1 million profit, and no capital gains tax on the $2 million in profit. That's really the significant benefit, says Tyler Mulligan, a professor of law and government at UNC Chapel Hill. But getting into the game requires, of course, significant capital. I don't know that this is any different investor class from traditional private equity projects. It's the same people. It's just diverting where they would otherwise put their capital into these tax-incentivized projects, Woolridge says. It's largely higher net worth individuals. You have to have significant capital gains in successful projects previously to be able to reinvest them. The IRS says the goal of the zones is to spur economic development and job creation in distressed communities. And Commerce notes the state has 252 census tracts that are opportunity zones, representing 1.1 million people, 50,000 businesses, and 45,000 families in poverty. But a Triangle Business Journal analysis of the state's opportunity zones shows there are many areas in the zones that aren't exactly distressed, and not just in downtown Raleigh. East Franklin Street, across from the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill, is an opportunity zone. So is the Durham Bulls Athletic Park. In eastern North Carolina, Ocracoke Island is an opportunity zone, as are areas of booming Wilmington, such as land around UNC Wilmington and downtown. Even Biltmore Village, just outside the gates of the Biltmore Estate, is an opportunity zone. The program set certain conditions for which census tracts could be designated opportunity zones, but it also allowed for some areas adjacent to those tracts to be zones as well. Edwin Pugh, a senior vice president who specializes in commercial real estate at Pinnacle Bank in Raleigh, says he is seeing the most interest in the program in the urban areas. A lot of the areas that have been identified are where development is going. It seems to be in the path, he says. I haven't seen a whole lot of change in the way that the developers have developed new sites. I think it's a catalyst if a group is moving from one project to another. Will dollars eventually flow to more poor regions? We hope it will result in investment in areas that desperately need it, but we're cautiously optimistic, UNC's Mulligan says, adding, the advice we've given local governments is go ahead and share what's attractive about your opportunity zone, but realize that you really need to have an attractive project to make an opportunity zone investor want to invest in your community. Investors are watching closely. The tax incentive idea behind Opportunity Zones is right on target. Invest long-term in underperforming regions and your federal taxes will be waived. I like the fundamental proposition, says Greg Sandruder, managing partner of HM Partners. I have not yet invested in Opportunity Zones because, first and foremost, the business reason to be in that region, that location, has to be standalone. Will the venture be profitable in that place? If that answer is yes, then a waiver of federal taxes is icing on the cake. If not, it would be unwise to invest in that property or business in that location, regardless of the tax benefit. And there's also a separate Opportunity Zones in the Triangle section. The Opportunity Zone program has plenty of land available in rural counties, such as a wide swath of land in Chatham County, but it also includes some areas in the Triangle that are right at the heart of the region's growth. That includes part of downtown Raleigh, only a few blocks from the state capitol, as well as locations on Franklin Street in Chapel Hill and in downtown Durham. There are big patches of rural land in Johnston County that have been designated as Opportunity Zones, and even part of the downtown of fast-growing Clayton is an Opportunity Zone. Wake County. Slashing across the southern part of Raleigh's downtown district is Lenore Street, and that's the edge of a large opportunity zone expected to attract heavy investment in the coming years. The zone includes part of Chavis Park to the east and then stretches across to Lake Wheeler Road, which runs across the boundary of Dorothea Dix Park. That part of the opportunity zone goes all the way to 1010 Road on one side, and to the east goes to the Johnston County line. It's not the only opportunity zone in Wake County. Parts of Knightdale, Northeast Raleigh, and even Cary are now opportunity zones. Durham County has 7 opportunity zones and a total of 60 census tracts. The only zone that readily comes to mind at Durham Bulls Athletic Park is the strike zone, but think again. The downtown Durham baseball field is actually part of an opportunity zone, Track 22, as is much of downtown. There are other fascinating parts of Durham designated as opportunity zones as well, such as land right across Irwin Road from Duke University, plus an area off 15501 that includes the Commons at University Place Shopping Center. Orange County has 1 opportunity zone and a total of 28 census tracts. The iconic part of downtown Chapel Hill is located in the 100 block of East Franklin Street, right across from the UNC campus. And that part to the east of Columbia Street and north of Franklin is an opportunity zone, tract 114, that includes the businesses on Franklin Street, the fraternity and sorority houses behind them, and even the pricey homes in the Tony Franklin Rosemary Historic District. Interestingly, there are no opportunity zones in Carrboro. Johnston County has 4 opportunity zones and 25 census tracts. Large parts of what remains rural land in Johnston County, such as the area around the small community of Wilson's Mills, is in the opportunity zone. But the opportunity zone also flows into the fast-growing town of Clayton, stopping at Lombard Street on the southern side of town. So if you are having a jumbo chicken wings at the Flipside Restaurant and Pub, then you are in an opportunity zone. But if you cross the street to shop at Clockwise and otherwise, you're out of the zone. And finally, in Chatham County, there are 5 opportunity zones and 13 census tracts. An opportunity zone sweeps below Pittsboro in Chatham County and rolls right up to the Wake County border. Much of the land between Jordan Lake and the Wake line is part of the opportunity zone. For example, you land in the opportunity zone, track 207.02, when you cross from fast-growing Apex into Chatham on Highway 64. Right after you drive from Wake into Chatham is the inflate-a-party business. And if the zone's concept pays off, investors may have reason to celebrate. And we have another article in this special report written by Craig Douglas. The headline, Opportunity Zones Mean Dollars, Fresh Potential. Thousands of neighborhoods are primed for an investment surge. Will a rising tide lift all boats, or will our poorest, least educated communities be upended in the name of economic development? Rarely has the federal government dabbled in social engineering without triggering a political backlash or predictions of Armageddon. Yet somehow Congress stymied even its most vocal critics last year with new rules encouraging investment in thousands of America's most underdeveloped neighborhoods, known forevermore as Opportunity Zones. The reasons for the muted responses are many. For starters, the new regulations included as part of the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act of 2017 are still being finalized and were initially so vague the Internal Revenue Service later issued hundreds of pages of guidance to explain how and over what time period the program is designed to work. Confusion also stems from the definition of what constitutes an investment in an opportunity zone, and to the degree said investments will be exposed to federal taxes, if at all. Another wild card, tax officials at the local level. Potential investors have expressed uncertainty over whether states or cities will follow Congress with similar incentives or interpret Washington's efforts to boost economic development as an opportunity to lard on extra taxes and fees for big employers and landlords within their borders, or will it be a little of both? There has been no shortage of voices from the commercial real estate and wealth management sectors heralding the potential payoffs in store for investors. Tops among them is shelter from federal taxes, but there are plenty of additional perks. Unlike traditional government programs intended to boost economic development, the Opportunity Zone program's benefits do not depend on an investor hitting certain employment requirements. Likewise, traditional limits on the types of properties or business investments that qualify are minimal. Less clear is what the Opportunity Zone legislation will mean for the communities in its crosshairs. By definition, Opportunity Zones are populated by low-income residents. A Business Journal analysis of thousands of these designated areas found them to be, on average, undereducated and plagued by high home vacancy rates relative to national, state, and county averages. Most are majority Black or Hispanic. Some economists and policymakers caution the law's loose language is ripe to be gamed or at the very least exploited outside the spirit of the Opportunity Zone program's intent. Concerns over gentrification with the displacement of poor minority neighborhoods in the name of economic development are legitimate, they say, and are likely to play out in unexpected ways should the program work as designed. The clock is ticking. Investors have only a few more months to maximize the program's benefits, estimated in the billions. Whether that payoff ultimately will benefit the country or just the investors with the means and motivation to take advantage of the program remains a great unknown. And now we turn to Biz, a quick glance at Triangle Happenings, written by managing editor Dane Huffman. Atlantic Beach rebuild seeks to retain funky feel. New buildings and new hopes are sprouting along the circle at Atlantic Beach as a town whacked by Hurricane Florence and the recession rebounds. The circle has always been a crossroad of North Carolina, a mix of affluent Raleigh families and Cherry Point Marines and preppy students. Going back to the 1920s, that was the heart of our town, Mayor Trace Cooper says. Starting in the 30s, there were a couple of nice hotels. It was the real epicenter of Atlantic Beach and the North Carolina coast. But the circle got seedy, so the town turned to developer Fred Bunn of Wilson. He bought property from 25 different owners and quips, "We met some real characters in the process, too." Changes delayed by the recession are underway. Townhomes rise by the ocean and new development lines the circle's west side, with residences above and businesses such as a gelato parlor below. Even the Tackle Box Tavern, after half a century, is moving to a swankier spot. Bunn says about 55 total units have been developed and adds, things are moving the right way. But the circle's center remains just a field, and the town yearns for a new hotel. Bunn wants to eventually put a hotel and condos there and hopes to finish the project in 7 to 8 years. We are fine in July, Cooper says. It's the ability to bring people to town from October to March where having a modern hotel would really help. I can say firsthand in November, that area is a ghost town. Meanwhile, rebuilding continues after Florence. The mayor expects the economy to take a hit this summer, although the construction led to a strong winter season. Ahead is more growth as the state builds a bypass around Havelock. We're not interested in a bunch of high-rise developments, he says. We'll be pretty prepared to manage the growth and not lose the funky beach character we have here. Here's how $100,000 in Raleigh compares. In Raleigh, a six-figure salary doesn't go as far as you think. According to a new study from GoBankRates.com, North Carolina's capital city ranks in the bottom half of the 50 cities in the analysis when it comes to how far a six-figure salary actually goes. After accounting for income tax and essential bills such as rent, groceries, utility, driving costs, and health care, an average Raleigh resident earning $100,000 is left with about $31,699, the report states. Raleigh finished at number 32 on the list, one behind Miami and just ahead of Atlanta. Charlotte ranked number 27. Topping the list was Memphis, with leftover pay of $46,092. Meanwhile, San Francisco saw that $100,000 dwindle to a deficit of over $2,000. The report noted that Raleigh had the eighth highest grocery costs on this list at $4,552. Annual driving costs of $12,893 are also quite high, but utility expenses here are well below average, according to the analysis. Holtz hold flag football event for a great cause. The Holt brothers held their fourth annual flag football tournament Saturday, and big winners were children who have a parent with cancer. The event, sponsored by former NFL players Torrey and Terrence Holt, was held at the NC State University practice facilities near Carter-Finley Stadium. Citrix won the title after finishing second twice. The event raised about $120,000 to benefit the Holt Brothers Foundation. Their mother, Ojeda, died from lymphoma. UNC Medical Center and Lenovo rank top places. For medical students and aspiring healthcare professionals in the Triangle looking for a good job, one might be well served to stay local. UNC Medical Center and Lenovo have been included in the Becker's Hospital Review's 150 top places to work in healthcare. The review heralds UNC's employee resource groups, academic assistance options, and employee discounts, alongside its investments to promote from within. Lenovo was selected for its employee assistance programs for stress management, work-life balance, and financial issues, as well as its benefits package. The company also won praise for its fitness and wellness center and its cafeterias. UNC and Lenovo joined just seven North Carolina organizations that made the final list, including Atrium Health, Novant Health, New Hanover Regional Medical Center, Pinehurst Medical Clinic, and Ensemble Health Partners. Airbnb says it pays up when it comes to North Carolina taxes. Short-term rental app Airbnb claims it delivered $24 million in tax revenue to North Carolina in 2018. That number comes as the Raleigh City Council just passed regulations for services like it, and its new rules prohibit whole house rentals on a short-term basis. According to data provided in a recent report by Airbnb, the $24 million is comprised of $9 million in state taxes and $15 million in city and county occupancy taxes. We appreciate our partnership with the North Carolina Department of Revenue, which has allowed us to deliver tens of millions of dollars in revenue to state and local government, Tom Martinelli, Airbnb Regional Policy Director, said. The parallel growth of the North Carolina hotel industry suggests that vacation rentals and home sharing are opening up the state to a new slice of prospective tourists by catering to travelers less able to afford hotels, those who desire to stay in neighborhoods or cities that lack hotels, and families who prefer to be together under one roof. Is public television a heavy lift? If so, he's ready. Biz runs across plenty of impressive people in the Triangle, but we were taken aback by the background of Lindsay Bierman, the new CEO of UNC-TV Public Media North Carolina. Bierman got his undergraduate degree at Georgetown University and a master's in architecture at the University of Virginia. He rose to editor of Southern Living before becoming chancellor of the University of North Carolina School of the Arts. On May 21, he was named the new leader of UNC-TV. And if you think public television is a heavy lift in this era, then he's ready for it. He is also involved in USA Masters weightlifting. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the On Technology and Transportation page, written by Lauren Onasorge. Frontier expects more growth at RDU. Frontier Airlines is not through investing in Raleigh-Durham International Airport, despite the constraints of an increasingly crowded terminal, says Daniel Schurz, Senior Vice President of Commercial Services for the Denver-based ultra-low-cost carrier. He says that while the next round of expansion may not be as explosive as its previous announcements at RDU, Frontier's growth story is not over. The airline is expected to release its winter schedule in about a month. Schurz predicts a consolidation of existing services. We've added so many departures and so many destinations in the last three rounds of schedules, I think it's more a case of consolidating, he says. There will probably be a little more frequency. Recently added routes north of Raleigh are likely to continue operating in winter. There will potentially be some more domestic destinations in the winter schedule, but we have added all the obvious points in Florida, Schur says. It will still be a growth story in Raleigh, but it's not going to be the scale of growth. But I don't think we're at the end of Frontier's growth in Raleigh. There's definitely further opportunity for growth in the city. Much of that growth might happen in summer flight seasons, where RDU is more of a bi-directional market. Raleigh is much more of an outbound market in the winter, he explains. But there's one big growth constraint at the airport, and that's space in Terminal 2, which is very close to full. We are limited, Schur says. We're at the point where we've had to write our morning schedule to fit onto two gates, including the red eye from Las Vegas and morning departures. While it's able to pick up additional space for the rest of the day, it's fair to say that the current restraints in Terminal 2 are putting limits on what we're able to do. Raleigh votes on Airbnb VRBO compromise. After literally years of debate, Raleigh has finalized a decision on homestay regulations, rules to govern the use of short-term residential rental services such as Airbnb and VRBO. The services would be allowed under the just-approved regulations, but just for up to two rooms of a residence. The rules do not allow for whole home rentals, and a full-time resident must be present. This has been a very lengthy process, and the needle here has really moved, Councilman Dickie Thompson said, calling the regulation a compromise. Thompson inserted a few changes, such as shrinking the maximum number of overnight guests to two adults and their minor children. Councilwoman Nicole Stewart asked if enforcement on whole house rental prohibitions could be stayed until they specifically were discussed in additional committees, a friendly amendment that Thompson said he couldn't support. There's been so much trouble with the whole house rentals, even in my district. Lots of bad actors out there, said Thompson. Stewart said that if prohibitions on the whole house rentals were to be enforced, she would vote against the measure. Despite her vote and that of Councilman Corey Branch, the measure passed 5-2. Homeowners would be required to fill out applications for special homestay permits, according to the city proposal. They would likely be required to submit a general layout and proof of residency. Enforcement would begin in 2020. Violations could mean $500 per day fines. Critics of the restriction say they could mean lost opportunities for the Triangle. Cisco puts robot to work at Research Triangle site. Cisco's newest employee is a robot, and its aim is to making the 7,000-person, 12-building Research Triangle Park campus a zero-waste-to-landfill operation. Christian Bigsby, Vice President of Workplace Resources at Cisco, says half of the waste on Cisco's RTP campus comes from its cafes. So we said, how do we eliminate single-use goods, he says. But eliminating disposable products creates an entirely new problem, getting someone to pick up all those dishes. So Cisco reached out to its academic partners, specifically UNC Asheville, and it went to work developing a robotic solution. Enter the new droid, which debuted on campus in May. The 2-foot-tall, reusable dish-collecting robot is named Cisco, that's C15CO, actually, or C15 for short, and it's equipped with light-detecting technology, intelligent sensing, and control algorithms to move in a large office environment full of desks and cubicles. According to Cisco, it can recognize human forms and will help employees transport reusable dishes from the four floors on one of Cisco's buildings to the kitchen for cleaning. If all goes as Bigsby expects, similar technology could roll out across Cisco's global operation. But for now, it's one building at one site, RTP. And finally, in a section called He Tweeted It, also porting Unreal Engine. And that's from Elon Musk. founder of Tesla, tweeting May 18 about the company's intent to bring video games to Tesla vehicles. Unreal Engine is the flagship video game technology of Epic Games, the carry company behind Fortnite. And now we turn to On Healthcare and Education, written by Seth Thomas Gulledge. Durham Pharma set to expand drug pipeline. With a $30 million investment from SaaS CEO Jim Goodnight's investment firm, One Durham Pharmaceutical Company is set loose to run multiple trials. NoBio, a split-off of Novan, has brought in the money through a private stock offering thanks to Goodnight's investment firm, Reedy Creek Investments. No and its portfolio of companies are working to develop a nitric oxide platform for a variety of therapeutic focuses. The funding follows a round in December when its subsidiary, Vast Therapeutics, banked $15 million in a Series A from Japanese pharmaceutical company Shionogi and Company. John Oakley, chief financial officer of No and Vast, says the funding is a transformational moment. "It really sets us loose to be able to run," he says. "We have multiple pharmaceutical candidates, and we can really push those forward in parallel now as opposed to one at a time." He says No still plans to be selective on which candidates to finance. Oakley notes the funding is remarkable for a company with just 20 employees and a low six-digit burn rate. He says the funding gives the company at least three runways, depending on costs related to development. With Reedy Creek's investment, the company reports $40 million in cash and cash equivalents. Oakley says the company plans to maintain its strategy of using a lean, energized team and relying on experts in their given fields. No plans to hire a vice president of drug development, chief medical officer, clinical operations specialist, controller, and sales director, but will not exceed more than 25 personnel. The investment will make Reedy Creek the largest shareholder outside of the company and its directors, though officials declined to comment what percentage the firm holds other than they do not control a majority. Oakley says the investment speaks to Reedy Creek's confidence in the company. "They see the opportunity in what our nitric oxide candidate can do," he says. "They are believers. They've seen our information, obviously pulled up the hood and looked underneath, and they believe what we believe. This will be transformational." Morrisville CRO expands oncology unit. A Triangle Contract Research Organization, or CRO, says it sees huge growth potential in oncology work and is expanding its team to bring a laser focus into the specialty. Morrisville-based Worldwide Clinical Trials, a mid-sized CRO, has hired Gaurav Sharma as its newest senior vice president with a special focus on oncology. Sharma says the formation of his position is part of a larger strategy to build out its oncology capabilities, hoping to corner a growing segment of the CRO market. While the company refuses to say how many of its researchers are dedicated to oncology or how many will be added, Sharma says 50% have performed three or more oncology trials in the last 5 years. Only 5% of the company's researchers are dedicated to oncology. Sharma says the company plans to increase that number because the market is demanding more oncology research. "Over the last 20 to 30 years, the standard of care for oncology has been surgery, radiation therapy, chemotherapy," he says, "but it is changing now, and it is really important to understand where we are now." According to worldwide data, about 45% of the oncology research market is held by companies with less than 10 candidates in their pipeline. UNC Press thrives while others face hard times. As head of the University of North Carolina Press, John Scherer runs an operation looking to expand its potential, all in an area when university presses are coming under scrutiny for their spending. Scherer says UNC Press is uniquely positioned to do something different than others during the cost-conscious era, give away even more of its books for free. Stanford University recently threatened to cut a $1.7 million annual subsidy to its university press. Following public outcry, the university reversed course. Scherer says Stanford's press was forbidden to raise money, making it dependent on annual funding and book sales. "We don't ever want to be in the position where Stanford was, which is have a single person able to make an existential threat to the organization," he says. UNC relies on a diversity of revenue sources to stay afloat. With an annual budget of just over $7 million, the press reports about $5.2 million in book sales. That nearly 75% cut of its budget comes from sales of monographs, which act more as a cost recovery operation, as well as the sales of more general interest books such as guides and cookbooks. UNC System sues Vidant Health over board shuffle. The University of North Carolina System has filed a lawsuit against Vidant Health, trying to prevent it from kicking the system out of the Greenville Hospital's governance. Earlier this year, the Pitt County Board of Commissioners approved changes to Vidant Medical Center's Articles of Incorporation, removing the UNC System's role in the selection of members for its Board of Trustees. The UNC System has been involved for decades, since East Carolina University's Brody School of Medicine integrated into the hospital, then known as Pitt County Memorial Hospital. Under the terms of the agreement, first signed in 1975, the hospital is overseen by a 20-person board. The members have been selected by Pitt County, who appoint 11, and the UNC Board of Governors, who are allotted the 9 remaining. Under the new Articles of Incorporation, the board will select 9 members from a slate recommended by Vidant Health, with Pitt County retaining its 11 appointments, effectively cutting the UNC system out of the process. Local hospitals get good grades except for one. In an annual grading of hospital safety, local systems receive straight A's except for one system. The 2019 grades of hospital safety from LeapFrog, a national organization run by employers and large purchasers of health benefits, are in: UNC Healthcare, A's across the region; Duke Health, A's across the region; Wake Med, B's for both its Cary and Raleigh campuses. Wake Med Raleigh had received an A in its prior review. The hospital reported below average scores for C. diff, blood, urinary, and colon surgery site infections, as well as surgery-related issues such as accidental cuts, wounds splitting open, breathing problems, and death from treatable complications. Wake Med Cary, which progressed to a B from C in 2018, reported many of the same issues. In the operating room, the hospital scored low for wounds splitting open, serious breathing problems, dangerous blood clots, and accidental cuts. And now we turn to our On Restaurants and Retail page, written by Dathan Kazak. Raleigh Brewery to add restaurant to tap room. The owners of a Raleigh brewery continue to live their dream. Ryan and Jennifer Kolaroff of Raleigh's Neuse River Brewing Company have always wanted to add a restaurant to their brewery. That dream is just a few months away from being a reality. The new concept that Neuse River will be introducing to its customers this July is a European-style bistro with a North Carolina flair that features fresh ingredients from the state. The couple plan on adding the kitchen and plating station behind the existing bar. We brought in Steve Jankowski, who used to be the executive chef at the governor's mansion in South Carolina under Nikki Haley, says Ryan Kolaroff. After Haley was appointed by President Donald Trump to take on the role of U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, Jankowski moved to New York. The couple has known Jankowski since their time in St. Thomas 10 years ago, when Jankowski was the chef at the Old Stone Farmhouse restaurant. Jankowski has been with the Haley family for 7 years and will miss them, but is excited to be back making his mark in the South, says Jennifer Kolaroff. Along with the bistro-inspired menu, the Kolaroffs plan to bring in a stock bar to be able to serve mixed drinks. Raleigh-based vodka company looking to raise millions to ramp up expansion. Prompted by interest from the investment community and acceptance from North Carolina vodka drinkers, the social beverage company is charting an aggressive expansion plan. The Raleigh-based maker of Social House Vodka recently filed documents with federal securities regulators to raise an additional $4.28 million to fund the expansion and acceleration of its sales and marketing efforts. The money will be used to retain and recruit workers, purchase additional real estate and inventory for production, according to Kerry Joshi, president and CEO of the company. We are in a great spot right now, Joshi says. The market is hot, and because of the current demand, the need for growth capital is imminent. This will be the second round of capital raising for the company. It raised almost $3 million from about 26 investors since starting the beverage company less than 3 years ago. Raleigh restaurateur Gaurav Patel is a part owner of the company. Joshi said in the past 5 years, large multinational alcoholic spirit brands' market share has been eroding because of the shift in consumer preferences toward health-conscious purchases from socially and sustainability-focused businesses. With millennials who now meet the U.S. drinking age, we find ourselves in a prime spot within the newly created craft market segment, he said. Local brewery to bring tap room to RDU's Terminal 1. North Carolina's success in the craft beer industry is about to be on display with a new watering hole at Raleigh-Durham International Airport. Raleigh Brewing Company will open its Raleigh Brewing Tavern inside RDU's Terminal 1 in 2020. Along with craft beers from RBC, passengers can also get coffee from North Carolina's Port City Java, which is out of Wilmington. Raleigh Brewing Company is one of the first women-owned breweries in the state, led by Christy and Patrick Nystead. The brewery currently has a 20-barrel system and a 3-barrel brew house. And finally, the Boylan Brew Pub now has new owners, new direction. With the recent announcement that Boylan Bridge Brew Pub is closing this weekend, plans are already underway for a new brew pub to open at the same location near the new train station in downtown Raleigh. It was 10 months ago that Christopher and Sarah Borison came in from San Diego and purchased the brew pub from owner Andrew Leager. The Borisons have hired Max Trujillo of the NCFNB podcast and The Kitchen Raleigh to help with consulting and rebranding the location. Part of that rebranding will be a new name, Y Hill Kitchen and Brewing. According to papers filed with the North Carolina Secretary of State's office, Borison filed paperwork under the BBBC LLC on March 25. The new brew pub is filling out its lead operators, keeping head brewer Brad Wynn. Prior to coming over to Boylan Bridge, Wynn spent 10 years as the brewer at Raleigh's Big Boss Brewing Company. Boylan Brew Pub's last day was May 19, but will reopen under the new name and ownership on June 5. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the On Real Estate page, written by Cliff Barnes. Developer seeks 40-story project in Raleigh. Interest in the Capitol Boulevard area of Raleigh is at a new high, and now Zimmer Development Company of Wilmington is seeking approval to rezone a property off Capitol Boulevard that would allow for a new mixed-use project to go up as high as 40 stories. The request was made by current owner Morris Communications of Augusta, Georgia, on behalf of Zimmer, the proposed buyer of the property. Raleigh's PNC Plaza is 33 stories. The 1.48 acres of land at 506 and 508 Capitol Boulevard, just off West P Street, is zoned for 12 stories. The land, which was used to house Fairway Outdoor Advertising and Smith's Auto Repair, among others, now sits empty. The documentation given to the city by the Williams Mullen Law Firm notes that the lots are underutilized after improvements to Capitol Boulevard brought the demolition of the previous buildings. The request indicates that the development would be a mixed-use property with commercial and retail space on the street level and residential and office space on upper stories. The proposed rezoning would encourage more live-work-play opportunities in downtown Raleigh, the request states. Another proposed 40-story mixed-use rezoning for property on P Street is currently waiting for city approval. Durham apartments sell for a whopping $5 million. A pair of garden apartments next to each other in central Durham have sold, with offices in New York and Durham. DTI Holdings, whose managing partners, Alan Gaboros and Jonathan Dayan, were educated at Duke University, recently purchased the properties at 2000 and 2003 House Avenue from Edgewood Properties of Durham for $5.15 million. Edgewood's predecessor, which became Edgewood in 2001, bought the properties in 1997 for about half the selling price. Durham County tax records show a fair market value of more than $3.5 million for the 2000 House Avenue property, which includes two other buildings, and more than $2.5 million for the 2003 House Avenue property. Both apartments were built in 1964. Medical office building in Knightdale acquired by Charlotte real estate firm. A Charlotte healthcare-focused real estate agency has purchased a medical office building in Knightdale. flagship healthcare properties through its flagship healthcare trust, REIT, or REIT, bought the 14,456 square foot building located at 6905 Knightdale Boulevard from Knightdale Medical Partners of Raleigh, who bought the land in 2008 for $850,000. While the most recent assessed value of the 1.81 acre land is $865,707, the building value is listed as $2.28 million. UNC Healthcare affiliates occupy the majority of the building. The other tenants are Pivot Physical Therapy and Vardy Chiropractic. The building has seen recent upgrades and renovations. In addition to owning the property, Flagship will also provide property and asset management services, along with accounting and lease administration. Chicago firm snatches property in Hillsborough. The Orange County Social Services Office in Hillsborough has a new landlord. Boyd Watterson Asset Management of Chicago, under its Hillsborough, North Carolina 1SGF LLC, recently purchased the property for $8.75 million from Tricor International Corporation of Florida. Tricor still owns the other parcels of the Hillsborough Commons Shopping Center, according to county documents. Tricor bought the land in 1988 for $325,000 and built the shopping center in 1989. The shopping center was originally anchored by Walmart and Bird's that later became Lowe's Foods after the 1997 takeover. In 2003, Walmart relocated, and in 2010, Lowe's closed its store. The shopping center also houses a 25,000 square foot Planet Fitness and various smaller businesses under 2,000 square feet, as well as three areas that are vacant. Now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the Viewpoint page, where we read the editor's notebook written by Sugata Mukherjee, editor of the Triangle Business Journal. The headline, Raleigh's new short-term rental rules fall short. On May 21, after years of deliberation, the Raleigh City Council made a decision on short-term rental services such as Airbnb and VRBO, and it did not go far enough. Five members of the council voted to approve one- and two-bedroom short-term rentals of houses, but not the entire house. Two members voted against the proposal, and Mayor Nancy McFarland was not present because of her back surgery. According to the rules, homeowners must register with the city and pay a short-term rental permit fee of $172. The rate is halved at the first renewal. Also, homeowners interested in listing their homes with Airbnb, VRBO, and other similar services must let all the neighbors living within 100 feet of the property know they are seeking a rental permit. It is understandable, given the growth of our city, why the local government must be deliberate before making any final decisions. The Raleigh City Council had plenty of time. But the council did not get this one right. Why? Because the critics of these short-term rentals are afraid the feel of their neighborhoods would be gone if strangers started living among them for 3 or 4 days without having any accountability whatsoever. Here is a suggestion for those people. Consider moving to a less populated area. It will be quieter there, and the demand for Airbnb and VRBO services will be limited. The same homeowners who complain about things such as short-term rentals, rideshare services, and Bird and Lime scooters junking up our urban streets would never complain about the rising value of their homes, and that has happened because of Raleigh's economic growth. Companies moved here, and so did the jobs. Perhaps it's true that the demand for homes in the city has posed other problems, affordability for one, but that's a different discussion. What the council should have done is open up the process of rentals to anyone and hold the companies such as Airbnb and VRBO accountable for the people they are allowing to rent in our neighborhoods. It makes no sense to regulate a homeowner who may need the extra cash or to use the property as an investment vehicle. It is not the city's business to regulate that commerce. Charge the interested individuals a fee and get out of the way. If the neighborhood suddenly is filled with parties, violence, and blue lights and sirens at night, then address it so the public would understand. Preempting the process by assuming short-term rentals bring the quality of neighborhoods down simply is wrong. The rise in the demand for rental services is a symbol of a city's progress. That means people are interested in our community and are coming here and enriching our culture and increasing our asset value. We can't have it both ways. And also on the Viewpoint page, we have a column written by Andre Perry, who is a David Rubenstein Fellow of the Metropolitan Policy Program at Brookings. The headline, Students Need More Than SAT Adversity Score. Standardized tests that are used for the purposes of college admissions don't predict college success very well. Scores on the widely used SAT and ACT tests only predict adequately for grades earned in a student's first year in college, and those scores are worse predictors for black and brown students. For what it's worth, scores from the SAT and ACT tests are good proxies for the amount of wealth students are born into. Income tracks with test performance. The more money a student's parents make, the more likely he or she will have a higher score. It follows then that the less money you make, the more likely you'll be denied a chance at a selective institution. And unfortunately, the divide between the rich and the poor is widening. The achievement gap between those who make less than $80,000 and those who make more than that amount has increased from 2012 to 2016, according to a 2016 ACT report. This is all troubling for the future of our youth, particularly for students on the wrong side of the household income divide. To confront these obstacles to success, at least one testing company is trying, sort of, to eliminate the barrier of income. On May 16, the Wall Street Journal reported that the College Board, the not-for-profit company that prepares the SAT, will assign an adversity score to each student who takes the college admissions exam. The score is made up of 15 factors, including neighborhood and demographic characteristics, including crime rate and poverty. The adversity score doesn't take into account the race of the student. The Wall Street Journal reported that 50 colleges used the score last year, and 150 will use it in the fall. College admissions officials are privy to the adversity scores, not the students. Researchers, including those who work for the test companies, have known wealth is strongly correlated with outcomes on standardized tests for years. There are several reasons why. Wealthy students attend higher-ranked schools within more financially resourced districts. Richer families can afford more tutoring, test prep, and enrichment activities. The College Board never claimed that test prep could improve scores until it was available for free online, at which point the evidence of improvement came rolling in. Standardized tests are better proxies for how many opportunities a student has been afforded than they are predictors for students' potential. Consequently, tests weed out budding low-income students instead of creating equitable access to institutions that help build wealth. This is why many colleges have abandoned using standardized tests altogether. But ignoring test scores won't make health gaps disappear. We must go to the source of the problem. For the efforts of the College Board to have a serious effect, they must complement true wealth-building opportunities. For instance, Derek Hamilton, who serves as the director of Ohio State University's Kerwin Institute for the Study of Race and Ethnicity, and Duke professor William Darity proposed what they coined baby bonds as an attempt to reduce wealth inequality among Americans. Every child born in the U.S. would receive $1,000 in a bonded savings account run by the Treasury Department. Each year, the government would make contributions based off each family's size and income. The lower a family's income, the greater the contribution would be. Children would receive an average of $25,000 upon turning 18. Those from the poorest backgrounds could expect as much as $60,000, according to Bloomberg. The money would then be restricted to wealth-building activities, such as attending school, starting a business, or purchasing a home. The program would cost less than 3% of the federal budget. Students can't pick their parents, but policy can level the playing field. For the efforts of the College Board to have a serious effect, they must complement true wealth-building opportunities. And now we turn to news from around the state in the Triangle Business Journal. Charlotte residents rally against planned projects in suburbs. This article is written by Ashley Fahey. Rezoning petitions calling for higher density in suburban Charlotte led to a packed house at the City Council's zoning meeting on May 21. Several residents showed up in organized opposition to a petition by local home builder Verdi Homes to develop a dozen age-restricted homes on Sardis Road between Oak Creek and Creek Valley Drives, as well as a petition by Blue Azalea Asset Management, another local group, to build three duplexes with six units at an intersection near Providence and Wendover Roads. While the sites are small, the petitions and vocal opposition against both illustrate a larger trend in Charlotte. As land prices, construction costs, and demand for housing continue to soar, high-density projects are increasingly sought for areas of the city traditionally developed with single-family homes. This, in turn, draws the ire of residents worried about the impact on traffic, area schools, the environment, and other factors. Even in Uptown, where Laurel Street has filed a rezoning petition to build affordable housing on the Shotgun Houses site in First Ward, some nearby residents complained about increased traffic and parking issues from adding uses to a mostly undeveloped site. "We just don't need more intensity," said resident Mark Irwin during the public hearing for Blue Azalea's proposal. He also expressed concerns that the street's tree canopy would be impacted and of the danger of adding more cars to an already crowded Providence Drive. When the council, the zoning committee, and city staff evaluate rezoning petitions, several factors are taken into consideration. Analyses by multiple city departments, as well as the county and Charlotte-Mecklenburg schools, are completed, as well as an evaluation on whether a proposed rezoning matches what's called for in the local small area plan and what is the existing zoning on surrounding land. Four Triad companies land on Fortune 500 list, but two big headquarters are moving out of the market. Four Triad companies are making command performances on Fortune magazine's listing of the largest U.S. public and private corporations of 2019, but two of them, BB&T and VF Corporation, won't be in the Triad when next year's list comes out. Here are the Triad companies, their revenue, and where they ranked last year. Number 246, BB&T of Wilson-Salem, $12.996 billion, down from number 245. Number 252, VF Corporation of Greensboro, $12.862 billion, down from number 242. Number 278 is LabCorp of Burlington, $11.333 billion, up from 286. And number 444, Hanes Brands of Winston-Salem, $6.804 billion, down from number 443. BB&T and Atlanta-based SunTrust Banks Incorporated are planning a $66 billion merger in September, which should net Charlotte another Fortune 500 company when the new headquarters opens there. SunTrust landed at number 304 on the Fortune list with revenue of $10.43 billion. Meanwhile, VF Corporation is moving its headquarters to Denver after spinning off its jeans brands into the new Greensboro-based Kontoor, or Kontoor, spelled K-O-N-T-O-O-R, on May 23. The departure likely will leave Greensboro without a Fortune 500 company next year. Kontoor is projecting revenue of $2.7 billion, which would have landed the company somewhere between numbers 801 and 819 on this year's list. Former Eli Global exec seeks to freeze Lindbergh assets. This article written by Lauren Onasorge. For Ajay Gupta, the federal case against Eli Global CEO Greg Lindbergh could come at a cost of millions of dollars. That's according to Gupta and his attorney, Nicholas Sanservino of the Noble Law Firm, who argue that Lindbergh's assets, from a luxury yacht to a $5.5 million mansion, should be frozen and a constructive trust be placed on his accounts. It's all to protect what they claim in court filings is owed for more than a decade of service at Lindbergh's Durham investment company. As the feds work to prove their bribery allegations against the Durham entrepreneur and his alleged co-conspirators, parties in separate litigation, Gupta included, fear the mounting charges could endanger their ability to collect the millions they say they're owed from Lindbergh's alleged dealings. "Obviously, I'm concerned because I have a huge stake," Gupta claims in a brief interview. "I was one of the key guys who helped him build that business." So he's taking action in North Carolina business court, with Sanservino filing a motion this month to prevent Lindbergh from divesting any property from his yacht to his Raleigh mansion. Lindbergh, who has denied the federal case against him through his criminal attorney, hasn't commented publicly on Gupta's civil case. But his attorney, Aaron Tobin, writes in a statement that the motion is without merit and we look forward to demonstrating that in court. Gupta insists he left a lucrative position at another firm to be paid a fraction of his salary to build Eli Global's India business from the ground up, relying on promised payouts that never happened. He had planned to fund his children's education at elite universities, he says, but since his termination, his financial situation has changed, leaving him unable to pay tuition at top schools, he claims. I just trusted what he told me, Gupta says. Gupta filed his lawsuit more than a year before Lindbergh's federal indictment was unsealed in February 2018. He claims he was recruited in 2007 to build Eli Global's operations in India from scratch, and he was told he'd receive substantial monetary rewards and stock options if he met certain milestones. And with our remaining time, we'll read as much as we can of the executive profile of Ted Christie, president and CEO of Spirit Airlines, age 47, education, BSBA Finance, University of Arizona. First joined Spirit as Executive Vice President and CFO in 2012. And this article is written by Lauren Onasorge. The headline, his plan is for Spirit to take off in North Carolina. CEO Ted Christie says RDU flights only the start for Spirit Airlines. Ted Christie, CEO of Florida ultra-low-cost carrier Spirit Airlines, has high expectations for North Carolina, so high that soon his airline will be flying out of four airports here. Spirit launched in Raleigh-Durham International Airport earlier this month and also plans flights out of Asheville, Greensboro, and Charlotte. Christie, in person for the RDU debut in May, admits it's a bold plan. He was hired as chief financial officer at the airline in 2012 and has been CEO since January. While his personal connections to the Triangle are slim, a year ago, his daughter stayed in a nearby summer camp, and when flying her in, the Christie family spent the weekend in the region doing all the stuff you're supposed to do, such as attending a Durham Bulls game. His knowledge of the demographics are high. With a rapidly expanding workforce, it hits two of Spirit's sweet spots. He says it's a crossover, both an origin market and a leisure destination. The challenge, as he explains it, is getting Triangle professionals to spend their money on airline tickets instead of a nice dinner. Your challenge is, how do they spend their discretionary dollars on travel, he explains. Your biggest competitor is that decision point. Ultra-low-cost carriers such as Spirit rely on a budget-conscious traveler. They offer a baseline price that, while usually cheaper than the traditional carriers, does not include frills such as carry-on bags and seat selection. Those cost extra. And he thinks it will compete among the seven destinations it picked for its debut, Baltimore, Boston, Detroit, New Orleans, Chicago, and the Florida cities of Orlando and Fort Lauderdale. And they're likely just the start as Spirit continues to expand its network. Christie says the Latin American and Caribbean markets, which the airline has labeled as part of its long-term international strategy, could be both a good fit for RDU, but he sees Spirit's place as much bigger than a nonstop carrier at RDU. Through connections, its recent debut gives RDU flyers 27 options, including connections to locales such as Colombia. The next step, brand awareness, and he hopes much of it happens through word of mouth as passengers share their experiences flying Spirit. Spirit is one of three airlines to launch a combined 16 new nonstop flights at RDU in recent weeks, the others being American and Frontier Airlines. And we're going to stop there as we have run out of time for today's episode of the Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. So long until next time, and if you have any comments or questions, feel free to give us a call at 919-832-5138.